now.
Okay, so I'll ask the question, if you're at peace with that, I'll ask the question again. Amjad, I'd love to get a bio from you in a moment from your perspective. I have my own, of course, because we know each other from a bunch of different places. But last time that we spoke on Zoom, I want to say it was like probably a year ago, you lived in an apartment with, as far as I remember, this is kind of like a founder legend. You lived in an apartment with no furniture, possibly. I didn't want to say you slept on the floor, but like,
yes,
these are not things that you needed to do.
Slept on the actual floor?
Yeah. So I actually, Haya and I, my wife is my co-founder. So that's already a pretty strange place to start with. But, we're moving a lot, right? So we started in New York. That's how Julie and I have a lot of common friends. But we moved to California. And since we moved to California, we've been, you know, founders, very early stage, struggling founders. And so we'd move from one place to another. And at some point, we just gave up on the idea of trying to furnish the place. Because we're just constantly moving, either like finding something better or just, you know, move from the peninsula to the city or whatever it is. We're just constantly moving. And then Haya and I like to, you know, think about things really from first principles. And it was like, you know, what is furniture really? That's like a conversation that we had. Like, what is the purpose of furniture? You need something to sleep on. Okay, like just put a futon or a mattress on the floor. You need a couch to sit on sometimes. So we had a couch. Or you need a table to eat. That's it. And so that was our home for a long time. And we enjoyed it. It wasn't that bad. But when we bought a home, now we bought a home and now it feels good to actually furnish it and kind of take care of it. So I think part of our mentality is this nomadic sort of mentality. Right. But once you start to settle, you almost start to kind of naturally gravitate towards like trying to build a place. My background, notwithstanding, the rest of the home is pretty good.
So you could create a Zoom a virtual thing of an empty apartment, and it would be like you were back there.
So now I have a new sort of thing, meme on the internet, because I'm doing a lot of podcasts. It's like, why is this founder grinding in his kitchen? All right, this founder, you know, I have a fridge over there.
And what's the photo in the background?
Take a guess.
I can't even see it clearly.
It's a little blurry.
Yeah. What is that? You tell us. I don't know.
So it's Bertrand Russell.
Okay. Got it.
Cool.
Yeah. In funny, yeah. I think I have that same photo in a set of postcards somewhere.
I'm a fan of him, but I'm more fan of the picture. There's something about it that is very, I don't know, very calming, almost like sort of like the deep in thought philosopher. And I just like that.
Are you the type of person that, well, actually, let me quickly go through the bio as far as I know. And that way, anyone who has not seen you or heard of your stuff in the past can get introduced to the subject of you and your company and the stuff that you've been working on. I know you from a bunch of different ways. One is that I know that you read a book of mine, and we've spoken about that in the past. And another one is that you were the founding engineer or one of the founding engineers at Code Academy, and Zach Sims is an old friend of mine. And then most people know you today because you're the founder of Replit. And I would love to, I think most of the people that listen to this are entrepreneurs, and I would love to go into that journey. But Replit is, as far as I understand it, or so says Paul Graham and some other people, gigantic and very, and growing at an insanely rapid rate. I'm assuming that's still the case.
Yeah. I mean, depending on which metric you choose, I mean, we're sort of early on the sort of business side. It's growing also very fast, but, I think that our claim to fame is just the community growth has been astounding.
Yeah.
And I use it for the first time on the weekend, and I must say it's pretty impressive. So I'll probably butcher what it actually is, but I kind of think of it as like it's you're coding in your browser, and there's also a lot of collaboration, so kind of Figma for coding.
That's right.
I haven't coded in probably 6 years now, and it was like super easy to get up and running and create programs and stuff. And I definitely like being, I haven't actually coded as my day job in like, I don't know, 15 years or so, but like, I definitely see that this is the future. Like,
yeah,
you having to configure your own desktop and have like a MacBook Pro that has X, Y, and Z, and just the configuration to get up and running just seems kind of just not something that you need to do in this day and age, and just having everything ready to go when you're automatically in the environment and you don't have to spend a week getting up to speed into an engineering environment. I definitely see that as like the future. So I believe in the vision for sure.
Yeah. Not only that, Kevin, but it's sort of like you, after set up the environment, you have to constantly maintain it because it's lots, you know, and you know, someone on your team changes something and it sort of explodes, and then you have to reset up or whatever. You join a new team, you lose a week just, you know, setting up the tools. And it's sort of surprising that Replit is the best execution for this. And the reason is because, you know, when I started working at Code Academy, the reason I came to the US and to work at Code Academy is because they found an open source project of mine that was one of the first to put coding in the browser. So we had a bit of a breakthrough. Yeah. And it got a lot of press. I was like a kid in Amman, Jordan. It was kind of surreal that like we had this breakthrough, and like the inventor of JavaScript talked about it. People were presenting at conferences, and we're like, yeah, I was like, what's going on? Why is this going so viral? And then Zach and Ryan used it when they were in YC, the sort of Code Academies. They were actually building a website builder, maybe, you know, pre-Webflow. Maybe that could have been also successful, but they pivoted towards the end. Legend has it that PG was encouraging that pivot towards like a coding platform. And they found some of my tools and they used it to build Code Academy. And then they came to Jordan, they recruited me. Zach came to Jordan actually, and I took him to the Dead Sea, and we had a really good time. We actually didn't talk business until the end. We just hung out.
So you work here now? Yeah.
Yeah. Exactly. And so I came to the U.S. And started working in Code Academy, but Code Academy had an education bent to it, which is like, we're going to teach you how to code. You know, comes from the name.
Yeah.
But I was like, of course, this type of tools will also be for individual developers like yourself, Kevin, for enterprise developers, for startups, for companies, for open source projects. But like, it didn't happen. And I was like, you know, I left Code Academy. I went to work at Facebook, worked in open source as well, worked in developer tools, and kept watching this space. And there wasn't really good execution. But almost like Replit, like I had to build it because like nobody else was building it.
Right.
Well, turns out I kind of know why nobody else like did a good job at it, because it's extremely hard.
Imagine all the languages you need to support, all the dependencies, like everything in the browser, and doing it all the back end compiling and all that stuff, and on servers that aren't on your browser, obviously.
Yeah.
I was going to ask you, it's an obvious thing in retrospect. I have to say, I would have suffered from what PG calls flex blindness. I would not have seen it. I had an assumption because I started coding when I was very young, and I just assumed that this is how you did it. And I guess a lot of people assumed that's how you did it and never worked on it. It sounds like it was always obvious to you. If someone is thinking about starting a company, do they need to have something like that in their mind originally, like you did, or can they come up with something kind of on demand, so to speak? Could they come up with something, because you need something counterintuitive that is obvious in retrospect, but that seems like a bad idea, or that seems really hard, or some other thing like that.
How much can we nerd out on this podcast?
I don't need as much as you want. It's for entrepreneurs. It's for entrepreneurs. It's not for everyday people. We're not going to ask you about politics, for example.
All right, cool.
No.
So basically, there's this thing called efficient market hypothesis. And the efficient market hypothesis sort of postulates that for any given information you might have about the market already has it and encodes it in the price. It's already priced in. You might have heard that thing.
Yeah.
So you're like, you know, your weird uncle saying that he knows something about Toyota or whatever is probably wrong. Like 99% of the time, he's wrong.
Yeah.
There's like 1% of the time that maybe you're right, but overall, on average, the market knows better than you. And so you can extend this idea of efficient market hypothesis, not just the stock market, but also to the market as a whole, to companies producing services and products, right? Mm-hmm. So for any given idea that you have, you might have say, if it was possible, someone else would have built it.
Yeah.
And that becomes natural for people. And so people generally stop there where like they have an idea. A lot of people do have an idea, but the most immediate reaction from them or from people around them is that like, what makes you so special? Like if this idea is good, someone else would have had it. Someone else would have built it. And so it takes a certain amount of hubris and maybe self, and maybe this is another PGism, which is you need to have some kind of like self-belief that is almost delusional to be able to kind of embark on a journey of saying, I know better than most of humans on this field.
And that's why
I can do better. But, so I guess the lesson here is develop a bit of ego maybe. But
it definitely takes a lot of ego, I think, to start a company. It definitely does, right? You have to think that you're best positioned to go and start this thing where other people may have tried or failed or nobody's tried. And I think ego, definitely, I could say that for myself. Starting a company.
And so I think developing that in yourself pretty explicitly of really saying to yourself, that if I have an idea, I have to believe that it is probably right and I have to try it. And if I got enough evidence that it's wrong, then I can change the idea or pivot or do something else. But if you really have a strong gut feeling or some evidence that you think this idea is good, I think most people would suppress that. I would do the opposite. I would like try to accentuate that. And talk about it and put the ideas out there. And then you could do one or two things about it. You could either start a company or you could invest. And Julian, you're a successful investor, but I've been using a lot of this idea.
I hope so.
Who knows? Pretty sure you had some big successes. I remember that.
There are some good ones in the hopper. Could you find another thing like that? If you wanted to, or is it just like it's inborn in you, this particular one, you know, it's a,
most people don't
find one.
I do constantly. And what I've been doing is investing. So like I developed some kind of, for example, like generative AI, I've been investing in it since 2020. And it was like very small checks at first, cause I didn't have a lot of capital. It was like a good percentage of my liquid net worth at the time. But, you know, a lot of companies that are now pretty big, I invested in the pre-seed rounds. And I mean, in the like grand scheme of returns, it's still not going to be huge, you know, again, because small checks, but you could just put that prediction to work by putting money into it. And again, you don't have to start with enormous amount of money. And so, you know, for example, like the reason I thought, like, you know, I saw GPT-2 in 2019 and, you know, I saw something special there. And again, like I didn't stop myself from like actually trying to imagine the future where this is working. Instead, I was like, okay, let's explore this idea. Let's dream. So GPT-2 was kind of fairly limited, but it was still sort of semi-coherent. It can generate some code. It can generate some text. You can like give it a prompt and do something interesting. It's like technology generally evolves over time and improves. And so I didn't have another startup in me because that one was still hasn't worked. So we started using generative AI at Replit. Now Replit is one of the startups that are big in the space. And then I started kind of putting money behind it. If I had more energy, I would probably start another company as well.
I think Replit is a pretty huge undertaking on its own. trying to get, like, I don't know how many languages you guys support and like everything that's going on. I'm actually really curious on the company itself. What other attempts at kind of this in-browser, it's kind of an in-browser IDE, but also it does everything for you, and can actually produce like production ready code and you can do everything on it. What other attempts did people make at this, and did they fail? Why did they fail? Has there something that changed that has made Replit like relatively successful, do you think?
There are two things. One is perseverance. So Cloud9 started in like 2013, I think, or in 2012, around the same time I started at Code Academy. Yeah. But they got acquired like maybe 2017 by AWS, four or five years into their work. And I think a lot of it is just saying no. Like, we've said no to really huge acquisitions. And the difference between a company that ends up being a really huge company and a company that sells early is like how many times you've said no. Like Twitch or YouTube or whatever, like had they said no, of course they would have become big companies, right? Instagram and others. And so there's a lot of startups that stop short of their potential. Sometimes the acquirer would actually develop them in a good way. I think GitHub is another one. Like, I mean, Microsoft did a reasonably good job, but who knows like whether they'll continue to innovate. But we've been pretty consistent. We started getting acquisition offers like literally like the same year we started, and it started like very small type acquisition offer, but it ramped up pretty quickly. But I was insane enough to say no, although it would have been not only life changing money for me, it would change my entire lineage, my entire family, my entire country.
Right.
But it's just this delusional self belief. And so far it's been working out. So I think that's one. It's like saying no, because I think Cloud9 could have built everything we built.
Right.
The other thing is, I think taste in so far that with Replit it's very easy to cut corners. So with Replit we added constraints that are very hard, that makes the problem much harder. So for example, we added this idea of multiplier by default. So you don't have to enter into another state in order to become multiplier. You can actually open the same REPL in multiple browser tabs and you can see your cursor. So you can do multiplier with yourself. So
I'm just thinking about the work that is involved, sorry.
Yeah, no, it's pretty crazy. It's a pretty crazy platform.
Yeah.
And the other thing is we want it to be reproducible. And reproducible and never changes the environment from underneath your feet. So we built on top of a platform called Nix, and Nix is this reproducible operating system. It's sort of like the Haskell of operating systems, completely reproducible functional operating system. So those are just two examples, but we did it with dependencies. So we just made our job a lot harder inadvertently because we wanted to maintain these sort of invariants across the system. Multiplier by default, reproducible, all these things, like we wrote down a set of principles that we wanted to do. And we wanted to feel cloud native, web native, like we wanted to feel like Instagram would feel like everything's accessible via URL. Cloud9 is not accessible via URL. Like a project is not accessible via URL.
Right.
GitHub's code space is a project that's not accessible via URL. You have to go to the GitHub repo and then open the IDE. And then, so like, to make it web native, everything needs to have a resource URL, right? And be able to pass it around and run it easily and all of that. And so I would attribute that to like maybe taste, because I don't know how else to talk about it. It could be something like like just being so single-mindedly focused on a certain thing to not want to cut corners. You could also attribute it to just like being really interested in the craft and really wanting to like build something so beautiful and simple.
I think that there's what we are picking up on, and I definitely see myself doing these things. And early on, you make a lot of like, I think it's great to have like for everybody listening, like to have a set of principles that you like, these are must haves, and like they're going to be hard initially, but like when we bake it in, it's going to make it so easier. I think that the opposite could be true as well. Like it's really easy to cut corners, and then you just see like as you grow a company that you're having, like whether that's tech debt or people debt or whatever that is like we didn't do this thing up early. I could say for myself, I'll use myself and the current company that I'm building, Airhouse, as an example. We didn't build, and it sounds so silly, but we didn't actually build native invoicing. So we're a B2B product. And invoicing is not as easy. We're a transactional-based product, and we were doing all invoicing through just Excel and QuickBooks and all this, because it's just like, well, we're just focused on the product, getting customers, all of this. But then it turned into this mass as we scaled. It was like,
you can only imagine.
We have all these, like, we have our finance team running these macros and all the shit, and like it's now our invoices are fucking late, and like it's crazy. And then it turned into like this big project that we now had to like actually create the invoicing piece. Mm-hmm. Our business is a little more complicated. We have a lot of costs and things like that. So it's not as simple as like a SaaS product that we just can just bill somebody, or there's another tool that we could use. But it took us like a couple months to build this thing, where if we would have actually done this in the first place, it probably would have taken like maybe a week's worth of work, because we build those things in. But we did make that decision, like we made it knowing that it would be harder, but we chose to focus on the things to get customers up front versus automating these things. But it sounds like your principles, like these are some of like the multiplayer mode, like that's a must have. Like if you didn't build that in there to begin with, like it would have been so probably like the complexity of your product, I only believe probably taken a year to do that or something like that. And that's also why like a lot of these companies that you see, and it's like, well, I find it funny that the investors are like, well, they can just go, they're doing this and that. It's like, no, they can't just do this. Like, you know how much like overhead that is to just add this thing, like they're whatever that is. So you really have to build like the foundation, and you need to do that intentionally. And I think that's a good lesson for anybody that's looking to build a product or a company or whatever. Build those things early on that are the most important things to you, and then some things that aren't, and then you have to pay the piper later on.
Yeah, you reminded me of this tweet by John Carlson that went super viral. I'm trying to remember it. Here we go. As you become, so this is a co-founder of Stripe. As you become an adult, you realize that things around you weren't just always there. People made that happen.
I remember.
But only recently have I started to internalize how much tenacity everything requires.
Yeah.
That hotel, that park, that railway, the world is a museum of passion projects.
Yeah, not only passion projects, but things that at any given time, anyone could have been like, fuck it. You know what? Fuck it. No. That's it. I'm leaving. I'm done. I've had it. Never want to do this again. But they, and many did. Actually, they're just silent. You don't hear them in history, right?
Those things don't exist.
Yeah, they don't. Those things don't exist, or they exist in a shitty form or something. It's, I want to ask you, it's, first of all, how many people does Replit employ today?
80 people.
80 people. Okay, got it. The standard, I remember at Breather, at my last company, hiring people by the equivalent of going to Jordan and talking to them and being like, I'm not taking no for an answer. I don't know what Zach did, but something like that. Mm-hmm. And I'm wondering if your standard, because the type of, you're building a type of product with, it sounds like exceptionally high standards. That's really hard to do. Normal people can't do it. Yes. And first of all, how hard is it to find these people? How hard is it to recruit these people? And And then how much better are they is maybe my ultimate question really to all of this.
Yeah. I mean, it requires, especially if you want to do it in a capital efficient way, like we actually sort of like slaved away with like on scraps for the first 3 years, like building the product. So,
when was it founded? Just so
we founded in 2016.
2016. Okay. Got it.
2016. We got like small angel checks here and there. And then got like a pre-seed check maybe in 2017. And sort of semi bootstrapped, for a while, and then got into YC a full 2 years later. Mm-hmm. And then raised our seed round like 2.5-3 years into the journey. Mm-hmm. So, today people, you know, are raising like pre-seed, seed A in like a span of a year. And then like we only raised like a really sizable round in like 2020, $20 million mm-hmm. Series A round.
Yeah.
So not only we had to build a talented team, we had to do it in a way where we couldn't pay people a lot of money. We gave a lot of equity, right. But still, sort of giving equity in something that doesn't exist yet or doesn't matter. So we had to get really good at discovering talent. And I've had to develop that sense. And I feel like pretty, good to say, like it is one of my, strengths to find sort of Moneyball style talent. So Moneyball is this book slash movie about like putting together this baseball team where and every individual is sort of a huge misfit and has a huge flaw, but you put the team together because every individual has some enormous strength. They kind of balance themselves out.
Right.
And so our first employee was an 18-year-old runaway kid from Santa Cruz. Literally this kid like didn't want to stay in his hometown or school. He was having trouble with his parents. He was like a good programmer. He came to the city and somehow we found him. I think he was taking it like a boot camp and he was using Replit and we found him.
Very cool.
That. And he stayed with us for 5 years. He's just left recently. And he's like, I want to see the world. Like I haven't done anything in my life. Coding at Replit. That's one. And then, we just like interviewed a lot. We were like very prolific at interviewing. We had a pretty good interview. We really thought really hard about our interview process. Took bets on people. And also like early on, we would actually not interview FANG people because we know they would never join. So we just stopped interviewing them. We just interviewed misfits and kids and dropouts and
runaways
and all that. And so up until like 2019, we hired our first like engineer who's still with us, from Box, who was like a Berkeley graduate, and then we had another like Ivy League graduate. So 2019, we started getting into like hiring more traditional type people, but even those, they had to pass like really rigorous, stuff. Right now we're hiring more from companies like Google and other places like that, but we still hire like very early engineers that built up platforms at Google. We have people that been at Google since like 2005 and 2004 and like really there's like talent in these places that are like hidden. There's like amazing people that you can like rescue them. And like, like that's how we imagine it. You go into the sword and you rescue these people.
You poor Google employee, I'm going to save you.
I'm going to save you, yeah.
And so, I love that.
It's just hard work, man. It's just like slaving away. Like recruiting will never happen on its own. Now we have a recruiting department, but all the like engineering leaders every week have to tell me what quality candidate they reach out to. People they thought that were they were amazing, whether they're open source contributions or they know them from the industry. Mm-hmm. So we don't just outsource it to the recruiting department. Everyone's still super involved in it. I interview everyone. Hi, and I, my co-founder and I just interview everyone still.
Right.
Talk to me now about the people that have invested in you that I would consider to be some of the smartest people. The distinction that you have made with teammates that you choose, I would also like to understand the distinction between the best investors and the class below. And so here, the people that I personally mean, I actually don't know all of your investors, but I know that Mark Andreessen is involved in the A16Z element of your company. And so is Andrew Chen, who is my investor at practice. But there's also Peter Thiel, who it's hard to agree with everything that he says, and some people do, and good for them. And then PG, who is very, like, I think disproportionately involved.
Yes.
And so there's got to be something.
Very unusual.
I think it is. Right.
Yes.
I think he's retired.
Yes.
Right. And so I would be too if I were him. Walk me through how they, in what way they are different than others, maybe individually or together.
I don't think it's controversial to say that VCs as a whole tend to be mostly followers. There are like very few leaders that set the agenda almost, and then the rest are followers. I mean, you see it in the latest sort of generative AI stuff that happened. There are a couple of firms that really were early on it, but then the rest were just like following. You know, same with crypto. And it's sort of like, I'm not saying that to say they're dumb or anything. It's actually super rational.
It's very rational.
Makes total sense.
Yeah, and but what that creates is a very different personality between the trendsetters and the trend followers. Mm-hmm. And the trendsetters happen to be extremely contrarian with very concrete and strong worldviews. And I'm attracted to that because I'm like that. And so PG is like that, but Mark is also like that, and Peter is like that as well. And they just like work on principles. For example, like when I first met Peter, he wouldn't take a demo of the product.
That's interesting.
And yeah.
Really?
And yeah. I asked other people and they said, they had this similar experience. And basically he likes to reason for first principles. If he sees a product, it's sort of like you're biasing his view. So
I want to double click on it. Say it. I want to hear it again.
He's trying to reason about your business from first principles.
Okay.
And seeing a demo, you are almost manipulating him in a way. Because demos are manipulative by nature. Right?
Yes.
Right. They're selling.
And so he doesn't want to be sold. He wants to understand the core mechanics and the theories and the secrets of the business and the founders. Yes.
But also, you could also, through a demo, I think you could be underselling the actual power as far as like, oh, this is just an IDE, right? And you could write some code in here, but like, you don't fully understand everything that's going in. So that makes sense.
That's also a risk, right? Like, for him to underappreciate the product because the demo is not that impressive.
Yes.
So demos tend to be hyperbolic in that nature, either like underrated or overrated. They rarely are correctly rating your appreciation of that opportunity. Instead, I think he likes to just reason from first principles about like how this could like play out.
I have a question for Kevin about whether, and Kevin, you can be as explicit as you want about this or whatever. And so SHIP was majorly and very known to be invested in by John Doerr, who if I remember correctly, found Google or something.
I don't think he was one of the first major investors. He did the Series A in Google. I think similar in Amazon and a bunch of other
No big deal. And so did you see something like that in him at that time when he invested in your round?
Did he see something in me? Yeah, I think. Sorry, there's a fire truck in the background here.
Don't worry about it.
Yeah, I think that's what he saw. So he'd never used the product. I don't believe so. He just, I think I sold him on the vision of like, what if like somebody had the way the ship worked was like, what if like you could take a picture of whatever you wanted and magically appear somewhere else in the world? And that was kind of the large idea with Ship. And that's what sold him on that. It's like this, if this worked, it could be revolutionary. Unfortunately, it didn't for a lot of reasons. But that's the reason that he was very similar into that. And I think that he saw it, that I thought really large. And I saw this as a completely industry disrupting opportunity, and I wanted to go solve it. And he's really drawn to those types of things. He's also a big investor in DoorDash as well, later on in his career. And I think that I would put him in the same camp, obviously, as like the market, maybe even higher, based on his track record, that he really likes to invest in big things, but a lot of those big things just don't work as well. So that's kind of the double-edged sword.
Closest experience that I've had, it relates to, it's Peter's fund that he originally used, I think, to get New Zealand citizenship. Maybe it's a couple guys where the fund is called Valar, and they were major investors in Breather by a lot, and we spent a lot of time together, and they had disproportionately principle-based views, and because it became a real fund after they found Zero, which was an incredible company that was based in New Zealand, and blew it out. And one of the ways in which this is like a little bit kind of like inside baseball, but one of the ways that they did that is that they had an insane fund concentration into single companies. And most funds, this is inside baseball, just 1 minute in this, will maybe invest 5% of their fund into one company or 10% of their fund. So if you have $100 million fund, you maybe put 10 million into a company that you really believe in, and that's going somewhere. And Valar, I don't know if it's the case today, but it was at the time, had importantly like a 25% concentration in a single company. And so they would invest 25% of their fund in one company that where they're like, this is happening. Because
was
they
it
would
Palantir?
Palantir, they did this several
SpaceX?
Times.
Was it SpaceX?
They did
which
it
is interesting because it's his company as well.
They did it with a ton of different companies. They did it with TransferWise, which was a gigantic now called Wise in the UK. And they did it with a lot of fintech companies because, of course, they have the PayPal roots, and one of the guys is in the PayPal mafia. So they would have unusual views, and they would go so far as to be like, if you don't have gigantic fund concentration into one company, then you're a shitty investor. Which is surely something that they would get from Peter, right? That kind of like really hardcore, strong principle-based view.
Yes. Yeah. That's really wild. And like, you know, other investors just think a lot about portfolio concentration.
Totally.
And they run a lot of simulation, and they really care about like, you know, trying to find the winners, spreading out evenly, and then maybe following the winner as they start winning. The idea of like putting like ahead of time, like 25% of the fund into something is hugely contrarian.
Yeah.
And it sounds like it worked a few times. So it was pretty wild.
It did suffer. Yeah. And that way your winners are big, because what happens in tech is you just need to be right once.
Yes.
And it's one of the amazing things that keeps me in tech is like, it doesn't matter if you fail actually, because it's just a single proper bet will get there. Did you have other bets, Amjad, that you believed were of this size and level of rightness before Replit? Or is this the first real one where you're like, oh, this is happening to me?
No, I mean, in a way, my career has been concentrated on this problem because, like, you know, my open source career going into Code Academy. And then even at Facebook, I worked on developer tools for React and React Native. And while it's not particularly like coding the browser, it's really about developer productivity. And with React Native, we took a similar approach to like what we do with Replit, which is make the environment super easy to set up. And we had this metric called time till Hello World, because Hello World was the first app people build. And so
that's what I did on Saturday.
Yeah. So in Xcode, to build like a Hello World app, you just have to install half the world gigabytes and then like, you know, figure out Xcode, set it up a simulator, whatever. With React Native, we just made it so that like you can just point your phone to like a QR code or whatever and start coding on your phone with React Native. And literally with 5 minutes, you can set up an environment and start coding. And with Replit, it's like the same stuff. It's like, it's only incidental that it's like browser-based coding. It's an important feature, but because we have an app right now, we have a native app built in React Native. Mm. It's really about making programming this enjoyable thing that removes all the drudgery of the IP setup and all this menial work. And so ultimately, like, I think my career is sort of a concentrated bet on making software more fun, more accessible, and the idea that more and more people would want to do software work, especially with the world that we're headed in, where more things are going to get automated, the need for software will continue to grow. People will have more idiosyncratic needs for software companies, SMBs, individuals even. And the idea that developers are going to be influencers, are going to be creators. That was like a big bet early on as well. And now it's happening. Like, there's like Twitch streamers that have millions of followers that are coding. Yeah. And we have like a creator platform on Replit where you can like follow people, you can tip them, you can do all that stuff.
Oh, that's cool.
Yeah. And so it's really one thing, but then I generate a lot of ideas and I try to put them in the air, or I try to like invest in companies. Like, a lot of companies started from my tweets, and then some of them I invest in them. Like, I would tweet a lot about like an idea I'm like really passionate about, and then someone would email me, it was like, we're starting this company, and then like I get to invest in that. And I'm just like trying to be like a very positive sum player in the ecosystem. If I get to have some I think in the end I'll be able to like create a lot of returns, but what I care about is just like being a good player, right? And I think that's what matters, and I think over time that's really what compounds and what opens up a lot of opportunities for you.
Oh my god, I wonder, awesome. Will he stay gone? It's definitely not zero sum. I think that's what he's trying to say. I'll say, do you mean player, like you're playing a game? Is that what you mean?
Yeah, I think of most things as a game. I'm like a gamer originally. I actually started gaming as a teenager, and I went into professional gaming and traveled to like Turkey from Jordan and other places.
Yeah.
Was winning tournaments and all of that. So my a lot of my approach to life is sort of gaming oriented. And so, like, you know, when you're trying to be a certain player, when you look at it when you look at Silicon Valley as a game, it has like certain rules.
Yeah. That's certain, good.
Yeah. And it becomes like a lot easier, and it's also becomes less emotional.
Yeah.
And so Twitter is a big part of that game. Like, Twitter is a huge like PvP platform.
That's interesting.
And it's sort of like people who know how to utilize Twitter. Do you know that account Rune?
Yes, I do. Okay, go on about it. Yeah.
Uh-huh. Yeah. So so, you know, Rune, for example, was like started as this like anonymous account and whatever.
Yeah.
And now, you know, he's very famous within powerful people. I see him at dinners with billionaires, you know.
Okay.
I think he has like a small fund now.
But is he actually a rando, or is he someone successful?
No. He was a semi rando. I would say he's like an ML engineer somewhere.
Okay,
and now
got
he's
it.
Like not a rando at all.
Right? Not anymore. So,
not anymore. And there's like just one story. But there's a ton of stories where people just through the act of like putting content online that like powerful people like, it will change your life, right?
I have to ask you about the games, because where I really started pulling from this, there was a period in time in my life where I stopped playing games because I believed I would not be productive anymore. That time has passed, and now I actually think of games as a core part of my identity again. One of the places where this happened for me is listening to a podcast where I was listening to Toby from Shopify, and he started talking about Factorio, which is, if someone has never played this game, it's just a super insane SimCity, but on an alien planet where you're being attacked at the same time, and you have to build a factory to get yourself off the planet. And it's just insane. Like, it's insane. You'll spend 10,000 hours in this game and your life has gone by and you haven't even thought about it. And you're actually grateful that you did. And so I was wondering if you have any foundational games like that, that you feel almost like trained your mind. You know, there are people that do that with StarCraft. They're just so good at thinking about 10 things at the same time because they need to in this game. Do you feel like you had any foundational things of that type that affected you that much?
Yeah. I started my like gaming career in Red Alert. Do you remember Red Alert 1, Red Alert 2, Command & Conquer? And it was like a very simple game, but it had a lot of interesting strategies. And although I was like on dial-up and I was disadvantaged just because my internet was really slow in Jordan, I would play it out of an internet cafe with like really crappy graphics. But I was able to get up there in the worldwide rank, like top 100 players. And that was really interesting, just sort of thinking about strategy. And then we went into Counter-Strike. Counter-Strike is like a very individual-based, like aim-based game. So like if you're a great Counter-Strike player, you can like do a lot on your own, regardless of your team. But when you play it in a team context, I was actually not very skilled individually. But I had that strategic mindset, especially coming from Red Alert, and I think that's something what I'm attracted to. I like in Jordan, we had a team that was winning all the time, and they were made of individual players that were really amazing. There was also class dynamics where they were rich and they had like these amazing computers. They were playing every day. They had a lot of money. They had a lot of free time. We were poor and we didn't have a lot of time or money or good computers. And so I assembled a team again of misfits and sort of, we had like people with like good aim. We had people with like good rush dynamics. Rush is like when you move really fast, into a base. But I just like thought about the strategy really deeply. And up until then, nobody had really thought about strategy. Most people were just like brute forcing it. Just have the best aim and just go for it. And so we would do a lot of fakes. So we would fake, like we would send someone to a base and then we would go to a different base. And then when people started understanding that, we would update the strategy. We would have a lot more defense strategies. And so we started winning. We started winning the tournaments in Jordan. And it was really crazy because we came out of nowhere. We started making like serious money, like on a weekly basis, we're making like $50-$100 each. And then we had bigger ambitions and we went to Turkey to work, to play at the CPL. CPL was this American league, that was going international. So Turkey was one of their stops, and we went there and we just lost like crazy. We lost to this German team called Mouse Sports, which I think they're still going. And I just realized like you can feel like you're on top of the world and you can like be a really good player in one area, but the world is really big and there's going to be people that are 100 times.
Right. Yeah.
Kevin, welcome back.
Thank you. Yeah, I don't know what happened there. I refreshed and I'm back and I hope everything's fine.
Yeah. It's intense over there. You got fire. You got jets. Explosions.
My office is in Oakland, so.
I'm wondering, do you think that, you know, you hear you talk about hiring misfits. All the people, not all of them, but a big portion that I've hired that have been quote unquote 10X, whether they've been engineers or not, they have this quality where maybe they don't at Google, I don't know, because they're not mispriced there. But we have to, like the people on this panel and a bunch of us outside listening to this, we have to find mispriced assets, so to speak, right?
Right.
And a part of finding a mispriced asset is that they're a misfit in some kind. I'm wondering whether there are signals in people's childhood in a lot of cases. Like you're taught, Kevin, I know you were an eBay power seller at like 14 or something like that.
Yep.
I'm not sure, but a bunch of weird stuff. And Amjad, you're talking about this sort of world-class like games competition. Are you finding that that's true among your misfit engineers as well? And do you think like among entrepreneurs, it's unusually common?
So the common saying, and I think Elon sort of popularized that, is to look for exceptional achievements at an early age, which is kind of true. But I actually find that there are sort of nerdy introverts that don't really have a lot of traditional achievement that I'm able to find and employ, and they are like really great contributors. So one thing, which is kind of small, but the choice of tools I found to be very interesting. So, I found, for example, like people who use Emacs are very passionate about Emacs, especially in the early days. We're like generally really good programmers. And here's the weird thing. TripleByte did a study on the, because it's like a huge interviewing platform. And they found that there's a correlation between Emacs and I swear to God. And that was like after I had this heuristic, I was like, wow, there's actual data behind it.
Wow.
I don't use it as much anymore, but like Nix, for example, we hire a lot of people from the Nix community right now because it hasn't gone mainstream. Mm-hmm. Yep. Rust was a great signal initially. Right now it's gone mainstream, so it's not as much. So choice of tools, weirder the better, somehow yields better programmers and really interesting personalities. And I think it goes back to what we're talking about investors. I think just being comfortable with being different is somehow correlated with being creative or being somehow talented.
Mm-hmm. Totally.
I'm curious about Go. Do you know anything about Go just quickly, whether that correlates in any direction?
Yeah, initially. I mean, the thing is, it's sort of like a market. We all have it again. It's sort of like a market, right? Where the efficient market hypothesis kind of sets in at some point. But initially, you have some alpha. So you had some alpha in Go. And,
no pun intended.
There was some alpha in Rust like 3 years ago. It's all gone now. So, because like you have the early adopters, those are the misfit programmers that are really good. And then the late adopters are just regular people.
That's right. Yeah.
And then it just dilutes the market. You know, the market for lemons as well. Right.
What do you mean by the market for lemons? Can I double click on that?
Yeah. So it's a famous paper, economics paper, called The Market for Lemons. And it's basically about this anecdote that generalizes like pretty widely. But the idea is that most used cars in the market are lemons. Lemons is a term meaning like the car is not very good. And the reason is because like good cars end up getting sold immediately or via friend or via word of mouth. Only the bad cars kind of end up on the market.
Yeah.
And then the perception of the market becomes, oh, there's only lemons. Therefore, the average price goes down. So
that's interesting.
So peaches wouldn't want to go on the market because the average price of the market is actually pretty low.
Yeah. Right. Got it. Unusually low because there's a perception that the quality is low across the board.
Which is a self-reinforcing
cycle. Of course it is. Yeah.
So in the same way, you can also sort of apply that to different pools of talent as well.
Mm-hmm. You got to go ahead of the trend to be able to do it. So it sounds like you're saying that a connection to whatever tools are being used by the next wave is valuable. This is a little bit, I mean, it's it's true for all the stuff. Going back to the whole Toby Shopify thing about how he's able to get all these Ruby engineers, Ruby like quote unquote gem engineers that were super good in the early days, because that was, you know, they were disproportionately valuable at that time or something.
There's also another thing at play there we can borrow from economics or game theory. It's called preferential attachment.
Okay.
And basically it's like cumulative advantage that rich gets richer, the Matthew effect.
Right.
And the idea is that because Toby has the best Ruby engineers, and the best Ruby engineers want to work with the best Ruby engineers. So the best right. Ruby engineers go to Shopify.
Right.
And you just built this like talent density, and he creates preferential attachments and it ends up working for him, as opposed to like, it becomes, oh, if you're a great Ruby engineer, you go to Shopify.
Mm-hmm.
That's what you do.
I believe that it's probably true for you, because there's a self-reinforcing loop of that developers, even super young ones that want to, well, they're going to start on the easiest tool, and let's presume that the easiest tool is Replit today and will be in the future. You're going to end up with a disproportionate set of 12-year-olds that will be okay, and I want to work for this dude.
Yes.
He doesn't even have furniture in his house. You know, like I.
That's right.
He's crazy, right. Like me, or something. You know. So that's a bet you're making.
Yes.
Probably.
Yes, 100%.
And so, in closing, let me ask you a few questions about Silicon Valley. You began as an outsider.
Yeah.
And you start having conversations with people, and they don't know a single thing with you. So first thing, you went through YC 2 years after your thing. Do you believe that it was valuable to do so and to give 6% or whatever it was away?
If you're an insider, it might not be.
Okay.
But if you're an outsider, it definitely is. It's a huge door opener. It's a huge network. Also, if you're a B2B business, we were not at the time. We're just starting now, so maybe we'll tap into the network. It's like a great place to start selling software.
Right.
So there's a lot of benefits to it. But I think if you already have a network, you already have, you already can open doors, whatever, a lot of people choose not to do it. But I think for the most part, it's still hugely valuable.
It's an easy path to insiderism and your first several whatever customers, and also distribution method. Because they're all going to talk about you because you're YC.
Yes, exactly.
Okay. And who was the person in Silicon Valley or not that had nothing to gain, but that did the most for you despite that being the case? Take your time.
The difficult thing is, like, in Silicon Valley, we all invest in each other. So we all have something to gain.
Yes, that's true.
Which is... Which is like a good game theoretical concept to make people like more collaborative, right?
Absolutely.
Like, so it's hard to say. It's hard to say because most people interacting with the Silicon Valley, there's some business relationship. Outside of Silicon Valley, I don't know, man. That's a tough question. I sort of like, you know, my father comes to my mind. But I guess it's family, but yeah, my father is probably like, the person who's given me the most without any expectation of return.
Got it. And once someone had an expectation of return, we go into the Silicon Valley thing because they're investing in you. Who is the person that ended up doing the most for the least, let's say?
Paul, for sure. Paul Graham.
It's Paul. Got it.
Yes. So Paul is, you know, when in 2019, my mom was sick, she passed away that year from pancreatic cancer. Thanks. And Paul was like hugely supportive. He connected me with like the head of oncology at UCSF. We got a second opinion. He offered to give me money. He offered some advice. And that was very selfless and very supportive.
Do you find yourself doing the same thing for people in Silicon Valley now or outside?
I try. Time permitting. I mean, I'm sort of at a point where it's going to feel really bad for not responding to some emails or tweets or something like that. But I'm at a point where, like, you know, if I'm not like working, I'm with my family, and
right.
So time is the least, time is like the most zero sum thing in the world.
Yeah.
It's sort mm-hmm. of like, it's really a pie chart. You can divide it in certain ways, but as much as possible, I'll try to pay it forward. Yes.
Yeah. And trying to stay that way is probably super valuable.
Yeah.
For lots of different reasons. And also, I mean, it's the reason maybe that you ended up getting the idea in the first place, is you were super connected to the average experience.
Yeah. Right.
And so to be disconnected from the average experience is probably, whatever, it's to your detriment.
Yeah. Yeah. I have to hop now, but we didn't get to talk about the book, but it was, you know, mm-hmm. it was hugely influential on me at a time where mm-hmm. I was trying to develop more, bravery and thick skin. And, mm-hmm. And I remember doing the exercises and the book. So I embarrassed myself a few times in New York City. But it was, you know, very impactful, and I recommend it to a lot of like young guys.
Well, I'll send you a physical copy. We're about to print an edition for the first time. And thanks for being on. Nice chatting with
you. Of course.
And good luck on your venture.
Thank you.
Bye-bye. Second Time Founders Podcast, talking tech news. The show is a must, not some billionaire trying to sell you their book. We're coming from a real place, plenty ups and downs, got some insights. Join the discussion now. We being honest and raw, giving you real talk. We've been at the bottom and made it happen and much more. The Second Time Founders Podcast, more building, less talk.